Okay, so this morning I'm going to endeavour to give us a bit of an overview to the Brahmavihara practices, or just the Brahmaviharas. So in that I'm going to attempt to define what the Brahmaviharas are, give us a sense of them as both a vision and a path. I'm going to talk about the Brahmaviharas as a mandala, but with metta as a central practice. I'll talk about Brahmaviharas and their relationships with the enemies. And I'll also talk about the Brahmaviharas as a path to awakening or insight. And within all of that, I'll attempt to touch on my own experience or working with the Brahmaviharas. And I'll focus particularly on metta today, because in the next few days we'll be exploring Karuna Mudita and Upeksha in more detail. So I'll explore that in more detail and my own relationship with those in more details in the coming days. So I'll focus a bit more on metta today, but we'll do an overview of the Brahmaviharas and of a bit of more on metta. Okay, so what are the Brahmaviharas? So they're most commonly translated as the heavenly, Brahma as heavenly or divine abode, Vihara as an abode. I particularly like this word abode, Vihara, because I think it tells us quite a lot about the Brahmaviharas, in the sense that the Brahmaviharas are our abode. They're a place we can live. So they're not just meditation practices, although they are that as well. They are, more importantly, a place where we're trying to live. Yeah. So they're four attitudes or four ways of being in the world. So they are metta, loving kindness, karuna, compassion, mudita, translated in different ways, sympathetic joy or gladness being the most common, and upeksha, equanimity. So the Brahmaviharas offer us a vision. They offer us a vision and a path. So they offer us a vision in this sense of a place, well, both a place to live, but also this vision of how we can be in the world. So it's the Buddha's vision. Yeah, the Buddha's vision of Maha Maitri, the great love that we can develop and abide in, a heart of boundless love for all beings. And I think it's Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche who says we might not be able to practice them in their fullness now, but his vision is to not med love and compassion inseparably into his being. I'll look that quote up for you later on, Patel. It's a beautiful quote, and I think this phrase that he uses, to not love and compassion inseparably into our being, it's a very visceral description of what we're trying to do in the Brahmaviharas. It's like we're trying to make love and compassion and joy and equanimity the essential part of our fabric. Yeah, the essential part of who we are. Yeah. It's like they're trying to penetrate us. So you could think of that. This retreat's like trying to drink them in, yeah, like a sponge, trying to soak them up. So like we soak up the sunshine when it's sunny here, we're kind of trying to drink in the Brahmaviharas into our pores, into our cells, into our neural pathways. Yeah, so they become the way that we function in the world. So they offer us this vision of, the Buddha's vision of having a heart of boundless love for all beings. But they also offer us a path, yeah? So they are a description of enlightenment and the goal and vision, but they also offer us a path. So they are both the vision and the path. So on that path, we do the practices. So like you've learned the Metta Bhavana practice, which has its five stages where we develop loving kindness for ourselves, for friends, for neutral people, for difficult people, and ultimately for all beings in an unconditional way. The other Brahma Viharas also have meditations attached to them. So there's the Karuna Bhavana, the cultivation Bhavana of compassion Karuna, and the Mudita Bhavana, the cultivation of Mudita, and the Upeksha Bhavana. So during the week we'll be doing those practices, we'll be exploring the moods, if you like, of the Brahma Viharas through workshops and exercises, and we'll be exploring the Brahma Viharas through these meditations. So as you'll all know, meditation is a means to an end. So the meditation practices aren't the Brahma Viharas. The Brahma Viharas are these modes and ways of being in the world, yeah? But the meditation practices are like all other meditations. They are a means to help us to dwell more and more in those attitudes. So we do the Metta Bhavana, not just so we feel metta for half an hour while we're doing the practice on the cushion. We do the Metta Bhavana so that we start to live more and more in the way of metta, more and more in the way of kindness. So that's the same with all of these practices. So they are meditations and they are modes of being. So yeah, the Brahma Viharas, I think what I love about them is that they offer both a vision for what it is I'm trying to do. When I wake up in the morning and I've forgotten what on earth it means to be a Buddhist, which does happen on a relatively regular occasion, I can go, oh yeah, it's that thing that I'm trying to do. I'm trying to be ever more aware, ever more kind, ever more compassionate, ever more glad for the world, ever more equanimous in the world. Yeah. So they offer us, and that offers me a vision. It reminds me of what it is I'm trying to do, and it also offers me a very tangible path of, okay, so that means I get up and I meditate to try and remind myself and tune in and go always deeper with those modes of being, and they remind me of how to be in the world or how I'm aspiring to be in the world. So yeah, that's the Brahma Viharas. And I think as we touched on the other day, I think when I first met this set of practice, they felt quite complicated, like for, you know, three new meditation practices to get my head and my being and heart around, and all their enemies. And I just felt quite confused by the whole thing. So I think when the Brahma Vihara practices started to make sense to me was when I started to think about them in terms of the centrality of metta. So all of the Brahma Viharas focus around metta. Yeah. So they're all in relationship to metta. So Karuna, compassion, is where our metta, our loving kindness, meets suffering. So when our loving kindness meets suffering in the world, Karuna, compassion arises. Yeah? When our loving kindness meets pleasure, meets joy in the world, then mudita arises. Yeah? When our loving kindness dwells in the fact that life is a condition, is a play of conditions, that it is impermanent, that it has its ebbs and flows, its pleasant and unpleasant aspects, then equanimity arises. So it's loving kindness in relationship to life, in a way. You could say the other Brahma Viharas are a bit like different shades of metta. So sometimes when we sit down to do the Metta Bhavana, we're suffering ourselves, or maybe there's been a bereavement for a friend, or a friend's unwell, or you know, there's suffering going on in our lives, and we sit down to do the Metta Bhavana, and that Metta Bhavana is going to have more of the flavour of Karuna, because we're more naturally dwelling in that space of suffering, yeah, or just the world. You know, we hear the news and we feel sad about something that's going on in the world. I'm sure all of us are just really aware of, I see dukkha everywhere. So I don't know about you, but I see dukkha, I see suffering everywhere, whether it's in myself or my friends, my loved ones, people I meet on the street, the world, yeah? So when our loving kindness is dwelling with that dukkha, dwelling with that suffering, then it naturally tends towards the flavour, the colour of karuna. But sometimes it's our first full day of spring, the sun is shining, the flowers are coming through, we're with a really great bunch of women, yeah, good things are happening, and more naturally our hearts, our minds are dwelling in a space of, wow, isn't the world amazing, and aren't I really glad to have this body and this life and this opportunity, and aren't I really glad that these other people that I'm with are having this joyful opportunity, yeah? And then our metta naturally will take the flavour more of mudita, yeah? So can you see how these other Brahma Viharas are, put quite simply, kind of different shades of metta, yeah? What happens when metta very naturally goes out into the world. So when we take metta out into the world, these other Brahma Viharas are naturally there as part of our metta practice. So in a way, this retreat is a Brahma Viharas retreat, but you could equally call it a metta retreat. It's metta filling out as a practice, yeah? Filling out to meet the world, with its painful, suffering aspect, and to meet the world with its joyful, beautiful, pleasurable aspects. And to meet the world in its fullness, the fact that pleasure and pain arise and fall away, yeah, based upon conditions. And that's where equanimity, this flavour, comes in. So I say all this partly to explain them, but also to try and keep it simple. Because as I say, it can feel like, oh, there's three different more practices to take on, and what is all of that? But on this, you've all been practicing metta bhavana for some time, yeah? Some of you for years, some of you for not so long, yeah? But all of you will have a grounding in the metta practice, and that's all you need to be able to engage with any of these practices. So if at any point during the retreat you're feeling a bit overwhelmed, what is this new Brahma Vihara, just come back to metta. Yeah, so metta is always the foundation. So here on this flip chart, if you haven't guessed, is a tree. I should have got such darkness to draw it, probably. Yeah, so it's a tree. So the Brahma Vihara is, there's a few images that you can use, or that I often use to pictorially, symbolize the Brahma Viharas, and the tree is one of them. So with this image, the trunk and the roots of the tree, so the center of the tree, the heart of the tree, and its connection with the earth is metta, is loving kindness. And the branches of the tree are karuna and mudita. So that's the tree reaching out into the world and meeting both what is painful, what is suffering, and karuna arising. And the tree reaching out into the world towards the joy, towards the beauty, and mudita arising. So upeksha is like the blue sky in which the tree sits. Yeah? So upeksha is specifically the wisdom quality of the Brahma Viharas. Yeah? So it's like, it's the blue sky in which everything arises and falls away. Yeah. So it's an equanimity, has that kind of, yeah, that blue sky feeling, yeah, the clouds going through the sky. Another image which I like equally for the Brahma Viharas is one of a bird. And in that image, the body of the bird is metta, and the wings are karuna and mudita. So it's like the body, the heart, is this the channel, the pumping of metta. And then what enables the bird to fly through the world is its ability to balance its relationship with both karana, with suffering, and joy and beauty. And it's flying, of course, again through the blue sky of equanimity. Yeah. And what I particularly like actually about the bird image is that, well, the wings, I assume, of a bird need to be quite balanced. Yeah, because if it isn't, you're going to go around in circles. Or and I think I feel a bit like that sometimes. You know, if I'm very out of balance, and as I say, I definitely have got the tendency to see dukkha much more easily than joy, than so see suffering more than joy, then I do feel like I start going around a bit in circles, yeah? And I need to balance them out. And I think that's what's lovely actually about learning the Brahma Vihara practice as a mantra, as opposed to just the metta practice, is because it draws out this need to balance in the metta. You know, that loving kindness isn't just about moving towards people's suffering, yeah, to compassion. That compassion does need to be balanced with our relationship with joy, yeah, and the beauty in the world. Both exist, both are true. And we can't experience, I think we can't really experience fully one without the other. So if we experience a lot of pain, whether it's physical pain or emotional pain, it's quite hard to experience joy. Yeah. And if we're blocking off from a lot of pain, it's also quite hard to experience joy. So we have to be able to, with our metta, open to both pleasure and pain, to joy and suffering, and to the extent that we can open fully to one, we'll open more fully to the other. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, so let's just say a little bit then about the Brahma Viharas and their enemies. So the Brahma Vihara practice all have traditionally what is called the near enemy and the far enemy. So the near enemy is near in the sense of it's quite easy to think you're practicing the Brahma Vihara, but actually you're not quite. So it's near in that sense of it could be mistaken for the Brahma Vihara itself. And the far enemy is such called because it's almost like the opposite of the Brahma Vihara. Yeah. So, and so when we start to explore the Brahma Vihara, we inevitably meet in ourselves the enemies. So, as I say, when we start on a Brahma Viharas retreat, we're equally on a befriending the enemies retreat. Yeah, so it's just part of these, it's part of the practices. So meeting the enemies, and you might feel like you spend all week befriending your enemies. And that's okay. And that is equally one way into practicing the Brahma Viharas. Because the enemies are essentially what blocks us from feeling the Brahma Viharas more fully. So if we're working with the enemy, we are essentially opening ourselves up to that Brahma Vihara and being able to dwell more in the realm. So don't get into, I should be experiencing loving kindness, I shouldn't be experiencing hate. Because if you're experiencing hate, well, you're experiencing hate. Let's just be honest about that. And to the great extent that we can work with and turn towards the enemy's hatred, we'll find ourselves back in the Brahma Vihara. We'll find ourselves back in love. But if we're just trying to move towards love and blocking off from hatred or the other enemies, we won't get to love. We'll just get stuck in this slightly alienated no man's land. Yeah. So we have to open up to both, yeah, when we're doing these practices. In recent years, one of the best books I've read, actually, which ironically I brought with me on a Brahma's Viharas retreat, was called Healing Through the Dark Emotions. And it's actually a Buddhist psychotherapy book written by an American, not my usual reading. Someone gave it to me. But it was just really interesting. So she was looking at the dark emotions of fear, despair, and I can't get the third. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Fear and despair will do, won't it? Yeah, fear and despair, sounds good. But I found it really balancing on a Brahma Viharas retreat to be looking at, what is my relationship with the enemies? What is my relationship with fear and despair? Yeah, and loss and grief. And I was reminded yesterday, looking at the notice board, that I called this retreat the alchemy of the heart. And I think that alchemy is something to do with this. Yeah, that if we want to fully develop the Brahma Vihara, we have to be willing to transform all that other stuff. Yeah, and it's through turning towards that other stuff in this kind of gentle alchemical process of allowing things to change that the Brahma Viharas can emerge. It reminds me of this poem, which I wasn't going to read, but I'm going to read. It's called The Well of Grief. It's by David White. Those who will not slip beneath the still surface of the well of grief, turning downwards through its black water to the place we cannot breathe, will never know the source from which we drink, the secret water cold and clear, nor find in the darkness glimmering the small round coins thrown by those who wished for something else. Yeah, so we need to be willing to slip into this well of grief, yeah, to turn towards what's difficult, to face the enemies and find the Brahma Viharas through them. Of course, we'll all know that sometimes when we slide towards the enemies, they overwhelm us. Yeah. So that's a practice as well. Yeah. So to how do we do this? How do we come into relationship with what's truly going on and not get overwhelmed and over-identified by it? So Vidya Marley often talks about this in her mindfulness work. She talks about it as blocking and drowning. So often we can block what's going on. Yeah, we can block those things we don't want to look at. Yeah, hatred, grief, cruelty, pity, neutrality, resentment, indifference. All those things we're going to meet when we start looking at the Brahma Viharas. And then when we start looking at them, it's like opening the floodgates and we suddenly find we're a bit drowned and overwhelmed and starting to catastrophize and the world's just ended. So, you know, it's just interesting to, all of us will do those at different times. We will block at different times, we will drown at different times. And I think it's just helpful to know, you know, if you have a tendency towards one or the other, or just know when you're doing one or the other. Yeah, I'm feeling a bit blocked right now. That's how it is. Can't force it. Oh, okay. And now I'm a bit overwhelmed by everything. What do I need to do? It's good to know what you need to do when you're feeling overwhelmed. Being blocked is kind of easier. You just pretend nothing's happening and get on like life is normal. When you're overwhelmed, it feels like the end of the world, doesn't it? So it's good to know what helps you on retreats, or just generally when you're feeling a bit overwhelmed. personally having a hot shower, getting a good night's sleep, having a rest, going for a walk, having a good cup of tea are things that help me, or talking to a friend. Yeah. So it's good to know what helps you, and if you're feeling overwhelmed, to do what helps you. Yeah, be proactive in that space. Okay, so I'll talk a bit more about Meta and its enemies. So the near enemy of Meta is Pema, which means sentimental attachment, and the far enemy is hatred. So I was thinking about this and my own journey in a way of working with Meta and its enemies. And the thing that jumped out for me, and maybe it's the same for some or all of you, I don't know you, has been the journey of working with self-meta and self-hatred. Yeah. So I think, when I first came along, I suppose, how to tell this story? Well, I suppose I do feel like I've worked quite a lot with self-meta and self-hatred, and I don't feel like it's something you do box ticks done. Yeah, it's a journey, and probably one I expect to be on for the rest of my life. But when I first came along to practice Buddhism, I had just been wrongly diagnosed with a medical condition. I was told that I had a form of muscular dystrophy, which is quite a serious condition, which I didn't end up having, actually. They never did work out. They never have worked out quite why my nerves and muscles don't work quite right. They just know they don't. And 16 years later, I've kind of acclimatized to that fact and don't worry about it too much. Having a background as a physiotherapist helps. Yeah. So, but I think when I was first given that diagnosis, it brought up a whole range of reactions and emotions in me. There was a lot of anger and grief for my own health. But I think as it unfolded, what I noticed was that it concretized two views in myself about myself. So it concretized these two views that I was unlovable and incompetent. And it took me quite a few years to get to those views. And then it's taken me a lot of years to start unpacking those views and moving away from them, or just working with them as they arise. So yesterday I read you that poem, The Bud. Actually, it's called St. Francis and the Sow by Gower Canal, but it's often shortened to the first verse where she talks about the bud. So she said, thank you. The bud stands for all things, even those things that don't flower, because everything flowers from within of self-blessing, though sometimes it is necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness, to put a hand on the brow of a flower and retell it in words and in touch. It is lovely until it flowers again from within of self-blessing. So, that poem for me in a way has been a real cornerstone of my practice and practice of metta. In a way, just retelling myself over and over in words and in touch, that I'm lovely till it flowers again from within, self-blessing. So it's just, and it is, that's what I love about that poem. It's like, we just have to keep doing it. Yeah, we keep having to retell ourselves, and that's okay. Yeah, often I think so often I hear people say, oh, I'm working on that same thing again. I'm so fed up with that thing. But actually, some things, well, I know for myself, I will be working on my relationship with my body because I have a body, and that body does what that body does for the rest of my life. Yeah, that's not going to go away. It can't go away. Yeah. And we all have to just keep, whether the thing changes or whether it's the same thing year in, year out, we just need to keep doing the work, retelling ourselves in words and in touch, we are lovely. And yeah, in a way, I can really see how these are, with self-meta and self-hatred, that they're just two sides of the same coin. Yeah. So if I listen to those critical voices in my mind, you know, if I'm having a bad day physically and I don't know, I'm very tired and I'm tripping up all the time, or that happens. Then I can hear these voices in myself kind of giving myself a bit of a hard time and being very frustrated with my body. And then it's like, well, I have to just clock that. Oh, that's self-hatred. Where's self-meta right now? What does self-meta look like right now? So there, for me, I really see them as two sides of the same coin. Yeah, to the extent that we're lacking self-meta, we're in self-hatred. It's interesting. I've been focusing on my relationship with my body, which is very particular, but I think this tendency to self-hatred also manifests in a kind of sense of like a view of not being good enough, I suppose. Yeah, not being good enough. And that's been really interesting to work with over the years. I remember one experience very clearly about, 6 years ago. I was about to lead the first ever big young Buddhist retreat. Some of you were at it. And so there's about 130 people coming for this weekend that I was about to lead. And we had this team meeting with the team that were helping me run the retreat and the practical team of cooks and people that had come to support the retreat. And I clocked that I had this view that these people didn't like me, and I thought they wouldn't want me to be running the retreat. So that was a view that I realized I had about myself. And as we were, and I realized that because we were reporting in, and one of the young women who I had this projection on, she's very, very beautiful and very cool, and I probably wanted to be her in some part of me did. And she was just talking very open-heartedly about how excited she was about the retreat and how grateful she was to be meeting new young order members and how much she was looking forward to the retreat. And I just felt really humbled, you know, humbled by, well, what the position I'd been given or the opportunity that I had to share something. But also I just saw how my own crap views about myself of not being good enough, not being wanted, actually just got in the way of me doing a good job. Yeah. And it was really, in a way, it was really interesting because that was the night before the retreat started. So then the next night when I was standing up in front of these people, I was so nervous. But I just thought, just enjoy it, Singamati, just enjoy it. So just put aside all the parts of you that think you're not good enough, that think that no one wants you to be doing this, and who are you to be doing that, and just enjoy it. Allow yourself to enjoy it. You're going to do it anyway, so you might as well enjoy it. And it was a very strong experience, actually, of just getting out of the way of all those views of, who am I to be doing this? Which I work with all the time, doing this stuff. And in my work as chair of the Birmingham Buddhist Centre, I work with that stuff all the time. But I can't let it get in the way. Because if I let it get in the way, I don't serve anyone. Yeah? So I'm going to read you a quote, which, sorry, is on my phone. phone is on airplane mode, just to be clear. This is by Marianne Williamson. I'm sure some of you will know it. Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? Your playing small does not serve the world. There is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We are all meant to shine. And it's not just in some of us, it's in everyone. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others. You can tell I read that a lot because it's saved on my phone, yeah. To myself, mainly. Yeah, so in a way that's just, part of what my journey has been around metta and self-metta and self-hatred. So then I was thinking about Pema. So what is Pema? What is this sentimental attachment? And by the virtue of the fact it's like metta and disguises itself, it's harder to nail it. It's harder to know exactly what it is. But I suppose I was thinking, when I was thinking about it this morning, I was thinking, well, I think it's very subtle, and probably mostly when we're doing it is unconscious. And it's probably that unconscious drive to be kind to people so that they're kind to us. That's what I was thinking for me. It's probably, you know, you're nice to someone so they're nice to you. And that's not your... And this is where I think mixed motives are really important to acknowledge. So often when we do things, we have mixed motives. So I'm not being kind to any of you because I want you to be kind to me. That is not my primary motive. But of course, it is part of me that wants you all to like me, right? So then that part of me that wants you all to like me, well, will think, oh, well, I better be kind to that person because I want them to like me, yeah? So that isn't, I don't think it's as great as any of our primary motives for doing things. But it is where our motives are mixed. And it is interesting to look at this. So recently at the Buddhist Center, I was chatting with some good friends there, and I was being quite cheeky. I can be quite cheeky with people when they know me or when I know them quite well. And I asked someone a personal question, and they didn't want to tell me the answer. And that was fine. And I went away and I thought about that. And I thought, well, A, why did I ask the question? And B, why was I slightly funny when they didn't tell me the answer? And it's fine they didn't tell me. But it was a good reflection to have. And partly I asked them the question because I care about them. I care about them. So I wanted to know they were all right. Yeah. So I wanted to know what was going on in that aspect of their life because I wanted to know they were all right and I care about them. But I also had to acknowledge it was part of me that asked them the question because I'm invested in knowing with a view of knowing, of thinking that that person tells me what's going on for them. Yeah. So it was just really good to acknowledge that and just think, well, okay, I need to be really clear with that person. I'm asking you because I care, but you really don't have to tell me anything. So it was really good. It was a good bit of learning, and I did follow that conversation up. Yeah. So I think it's a subtler area. So it's a good area just to look at the people in your life that you really are attached to them liking you. And maybe there's something of Pema in there. Just have a little look. And just to touch briefly on hatred for others. So when I was thinking about this, I was thinking about an experience I had doing the fourth stage of the Metta Bhavana. Ironically, I was putting a good friend in the fourth stage of the Metta Bhavana. You know how that happens, yeah? How good friends become a bit difficult sometimes. And in this Metta, I had this, what unfolded was this sense of me over here. And it was like he was right over there. And if you can imagine a warehouse full of furniture and junk, that was all my views about him in the middle. So it was me on one side of the warehouse, him on the other side of the warehouse. And then all these views I had about him and what he should have done and what he didn't do and why I was hurt by him and how he should change. You know, all that was there in the middle. And I had this sense in the meditation of like, okay, here's me, here's him, there's all that. But I can just walk through the warehouse and meet him on the other side. Yeah, so somehow in that meditation, I managed to cross the bridge. Yeah, I managed to cross the bridge from me to him. And I managed to meet him on that side just as he was. Okay, who is this person? Let's leave all my stuff behind and just try and meet him and who he is. Irrelevant of all my views about him, yeah, or what happened, or how he'd hurt me, and da 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 da. And it was a very strong experience, actually, of seeing somebody from their own side. Yeah. So often we are caught, you know, we're caught up in ourselves and our own whatever's going on for us. And when we do these metta practices, actually, whether we're looking at our good friend or a neutral friend or the difficult person, what we're looking at is so often is our view of them. And often where that practice really takes off is where we manage to cross that bridge of our views, whether we like them or don't like them, and really just see this person on the other side. Yeah, we meet someone. Oh, that's interesting. What is that? You know, just meeting someone. Yeah, just looking at another human being. Yeah. So I think that was quite an interesting experience of working with hatred. And it did just feel like once I met them, well, the difficulty, something changed. It immediately broke. Yeah, that sense of... Maybe they didn't go away as well, but something radically changed. And often when I think about working with hatred in terms of the past, I do come back to the Buddha quite a lot. So the Buddha is, he talks about hatred very categorically in a way in the Dhammapada, where he says, hatred does not cease by hatred. It ceases by love. This is the eternal law. So when I find myself in a space of hatred, it's like, what am I doing with that? And the Buddha often talked about, I think it's the Buddha, or it might just be a legendary tale or myth. These things all blend sometimes, don't they? But this image anyway of hatred being a bit like hot coals. Yeah, so we can, if someone gives you a hot coal, you can keep holding on to it if you like, letting it burn your hands, or you can drop it, or you cannot take it altogether. Someone gives you a gift, you don't have to take it. You think you do, but you really don't. It's interesting, you know, when someone, I really noticed that when I lived here, on the rare occasions where I fell out with people, how much you hold on to that, how much I didn't want didn't want to let go of the fact they'd wronged me or they'd hurt me, you know. But actually, it was mainly just me it was burning. Yeah. So forgiveness is an interesting area. And we can't rush it as well. And We have to be really gentle and sensitive in the area of hatred and forgiveness. But I think in the end, we have to take responsibility for why we're holding on to it and look at whether that helps us and what we can do to let it go. Okay, so I'm just going to say a few things now about the Brahma Viharas as a path to awakening or insight. And then that'll be that for this morning. So when we do the Brahma Vihara practices, we can do them. They have a whole spectrum of possibilities. So in Buddhist meditation, we have this distinction often of shamatha meditation, calming, meditation that calms. You could relate that to the path of integration and positive emotion in the system of practice. And we also have what's called vipassana meditation, insight, which is related to spiritual death or spiritual rebirth, receptivity in the system of practice. Now, it's not like, so I would say that all meditations have both a shamatha and a vipassana aspect. So all meditations are there to help us calm and ground and generate positive emotion. And all meditations will have a capacity to help us bring insight. So ultimately, the Buddhist path is about both, yeah? The Buddhist path is about becoming calmer, more positive, more ethical, more open, more generous in the world. But it is also a path of awakening. It's also a path of transcendental insight and wisdom. And these practices offer both. The mindfulness of breathing offers both. The metta offers both. Or the Brahma Viharas offer both. Yeah, they have both aspects. And I think it's really important to understand the potential of metta as a path to insight. So insight is all about, there's lots of different ways you could talk about insight, but I'm going to talk about it in terms of breaking down the barriers that we create between ourselves and others. So often we live in this world where we have me in here, clear boundary, very separate, very fixed. Yeah, that's how we experience ourselves. And you out there, other, also fixed. Now Buddhism challenges all those views. Buddhism says that really we are impermanent, we are not fixed, we are constantly changing. And we haven't got this fixed me in here, you out there. And metta practice is part of helping us to break down these clear distinctions between self and other. They offer us that opportunity to break down that barrier. And that's insight, starting to see things as they really are, not fixed, always changing, arising based upon conditions. So Sangharakshita puts this really, really clearly in Living Wisely. He says, when considering these teachings, we have to be careful that we do not approach the Dharma with a negative self-view. If our gut feeling is that we have or are a self, it can feel as if the Dharma is going to take something away from us that is central to who we are. When in fact the Dharma is there to help us see ourselves, whatever we may be, more clearly. Perhaps it is better simply to see ourselves as limited. Instead of challenging ourselves to explode a deluded concept of the self directly, it may be more helpful to think of breaking out of the closed circle of self-interest. That is the emotional expression of our delusion. We can think of expanding that circle through the cultivation of metta, until our self-interest is absorbed in a concern for the welfare of all living beings. Overcoming ego is not just an idea. It is an experience, a way of life. So I'll read that last bit again. Instead of challenging ourselves to explode our deluded concept of the self directly, it may be more helpful to think of breaking out of the closed circle of self-interest that is the emotional expression of our delusion. We can think of expanding that circle through the cultivation of metta, of loving kindness, until our self-interest is absorbed in a concern for the welfare of all beings. Overcoming ego is not just an idea, it is an experience, a way of life. So yeah, in these practices we are trying to generate these modes of metta, of compassion, of joy and equanimity, but we're also trying to see how we construct the self, how we construct our own selves, what through our views of ourselves, through our views of others, through our views of the world, and seeing how these views limit us and limit our experience of ourselves and the world. And to the extent that we can see these views and we can see through them and see through them to a deeper reality. Okay, let's leave it there.